This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
Next, I'd like to call up Tiffany.
Let's start today with a riddle.
Good evening.
A riddle wrapped inside a poem.
Can you find my poems? My poems are in a place you could never go. They're not in my shoes because they wouldn't fit.
This is Tiffany Adams. She's an 11th grader at Ballou High School in Washington, D.C. She's giving a public reading of a poem she wrote, which is about poetry.
So can you find my poems? Can you find the place I hid them? The place where my pen goes? From in your own head, from in your own book. Can you find my poems?
Tiffany's poem asks a pretty remarkable question. Where do poems exist? On the page? In your head? Out in the world?
They're not in an obvious place. No, they're not anywhere but one simple place. So can you find my poems?
When you ask me where my poems are, I'm just going to leave you still guessing, because if I just tell you, it just takes the whole surprise and everything out of the poem.
Fair enough. But where does a poem come from?
It just happened. I was writing and it just came on the paper.
What does it really mean that words come out of you? How does an idea go from an inkling to ink? Well, today on the TED Radio Hour, we'll explore the mystery of the creative process and the challenge of nurturing our creativity. We'll hear from a best-selling author who went searching for her muse in some unlikely places, and a musician who finds her inspiration from the American South and the Far East. But first, let's stick with poetry.
I'm here to give you your recommended dietary allowance of poetry.
On stage at the TED 2012 conference, Billy Collins presented a number of his poems with a twist. They were animated videos. Let's listen to one. It's called Budapest.
And in it, I reveal, or pretend to reveal, the secrets of the creative process.
Budapest. My pen moves along the page like the snout of a strange animal shaped like a human arm and dressed in the sleeve of a loose green sweater. I watch it sniffing the paper ceaselessly, intent as any forager that has nothing on its mind but the grubs and insects that will allow it to live another day. It wants only to be here tomorrow, dressed perhaps in the sleeve of a plaid shirt, nose pressed against the page, writing a few more dutiful lines, while I gaze out the window and imagine Budapest, or some other city where I have never been.
Okay. At first, Billy Collins was not sold on the idea of adding visuals to his poems.
Because the mixing of those two media is a sort of unnatural or unnecessary act.
At TED, he shared the challenges of working through that creative process.
When I was United States Poet Laureate, and I love saying that, it's a great way to start sentences. When I was him back then, I was approached by J. Walter Thompson, the ad company, and they were hired sort of by the Sundance Channel. And the idea was to have me record some of my poems, and then they would find animators to animate them. And I was initially resistant because I always think poetry can stand alone by itself. And the poem, if it's written with the ear, already has been set to its own verbal music as it was composed. And surely, if you're reading a poem that mentions a cow, you don't need on the facing page a drawing of a cow. I mean, let's let the reader do a little work. But I relented because it seemed like an interesting possibility, and also I'm a total cartoon junkie since childhood. I think more influential than Emily Dickinson or Coleridge or Wordsworth on my imagination were Warner Brothers' Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes cartoons. Bugs Bunny is my muse. And this way, poetry would find its way onto television of all places. And I'm pretty much all for poetry in public places, poetry on buses, poetry on subways, on billboards, on cereal boxes. When I was Poet Laureate, there I go again. I can't help it. It's true. I created a poetry channel on Delta Airlines that lasted for a couple of years, so you could tune into poetry as you were flying. My sense is it's a good thing to get poetry out of the kind of off the shelves and more into public life. Start a meeting with a poem. That would be an idea you might take with you. When you get a poem on a billboard or on the radio or on a cereal box or whatever, it happens to you so suddenly that you don't have time to deploy your anti-poetry deflector shields that were installed in high school.
There was something about the anti-poetry deflector shields that really rang true, and I was an English major. What happens in the teaching of poetry that can repel a student?
Well, it's mostly, and I'm guilty of these sins. I mean, I've been a professor all my life, and I've committed all these sins in the classroom repeatedly. But it's the emphasis on interpretation to the detriment of some of the other less teachable, maybe even more obvious or more bodily pleasures that poetry offers. But that mental and cerebral pleasure seems to be so dominant that it leaves out other pleasures. And the other pleasures are not so teachable, so they don't require the intervention of a teacher. The pleasure of rhythm, the pleasure of sound pleasures, as the poem is a little sonic auditorium, the pleasure of metaphor, the pleasure of imaginative travel. All of these pleasures that we experience in a gestalt fashion, kind of simultaneously as we read a poem, are difficult to discuss, really. So the emphasis tends to be on what does the poem mean. And at some point in my teaching, I realized that when I'm writing a poem, that's the last thing I'm thinking about. I'm never thinking about what does the poem mean. I'm just trying to advance the poem to some point where it can stop, basically. So I started to re-engineer my teaching. And instead of asking, what does the poem mean, I substituted other questions such as, how does the poem go? How does the poem progress? How does it get from its beginning to its end? Through a series of maneuvers or negotiations. And in that way, the poem seemed to be more like an animated thing rather than a text that has to be reduced to another lesser text, the text of meaning.
Let's go back to your TED Talk. I want to let people hear one of your poems. It was one of the ones that was animated. This is Some Days.
And I think you could boil this poem down to saying, some days you eat the bear, other days the bear eats you, and it uses the imagery of dollhouse furniture.
Some days. Some days I put the people in their places at the table. Bend their legs at the knees, if they come with that feature, and fix them into the tiny wooden chairs. All afternoon, they face one another, the man in the brown suit, the woman in the blue dress, perfectly motionless, perfectly behaved. But other days, I am the one who is lifted up by the ribs, then lowered into the dining room of a dollhouse to sit with the others at the long table. Very funny, but how would you like it if you never knew from one day to the next if you were going to spend it striding around like a vivid god, your shoulders in the clouds, or sitting down there amidst the wallpaper, staring straight ahead with your little plastic face?
Thank you. Writing is not as actually as easy as that for me, but I like to pretend that it comes with ease. One of my students came up after class, an introductory class, and she said, "You know, poetry is harder than writing," which I found both erroneous and profound. So I like to at least pretend it just flows out. A friend of mine has a slogan, which he's another poet. He says that, if at first you don't succeed, hide all evidence you ever tried.
Billy, what do you do on those days when it just doesn't come to you?
Oh, the poets do the thing, go to the dry cleaner. I mean, the usual stuff. Well, I wait. I mean, there's this term, writer's block. I don't believe in it. I don't like to even hear the term. I mean, you can't be writing constantly because you'd be insane. So there must be periods of non-writing. And then it's just a matter of how do you view them? And I just view them as I'm waiting. I'm waiting for something to come along. And I think that's a kind of healthy way rather than thinking I'm not writing. That means I'll never write.
What do you do immediately after writing a poem? Do you put it away? Do you go for a walk? Do you reread it?
When it's really done, I go out and shoot some baskets or something. I mean, I don't want to make it sound too romantic, but I mean, it's a quite intense experience. And there's always the frustration about how will this end? My poems tend to be going somewhere and they end when they get there. I mean, and you need to know, of course, when to stop. There was a story about a kindergarten teacher. Her students produced the best art of any of the other teachers in the school. And they asked her, how come your students' paintings are so good? And she said, well, it's because I know when to take them away from them.
Everybody stop.
Yeah, because eventually it'll become mud if they just keep going. And she would see a good painting and just, that's enough for you, yeah. So there's deep satisfaction in finding an ending, at which point I don't want to say anything more, and the reader, I'm guessing, doesn't want to hear anything more.
Billy Collins, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Billy Collins' latest collection of poetry is Horoscopes for the Dead. You can watch some of his animated poems at our website, ted.npr.org. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. This episode is about creativity, what it is, what it means to our daily lives. And if you're a creative person, this next TED Talk could be for you. It's about how to protect our creativity from the outside world and from ourselves. Writer Elizabeth Gilbert experienced insane success with her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love.
The result of which is that everywhere I go now, people treat me like I'm doomed. Seriously, doomed. Like, they come up to me now, like, all worried, and they say, aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid you're never going to be able to top that? Aren't you afraid you're going to keep writing for your whole life, and you're never again going to create a book that anybody in the world cares about at all, ever again?
Joining us in studio is June Cohen, the executive producer of TED Media. June, welcome, first of all.
Thank you, Allison.
So for our audience, let's get big, start big and go small. Explain to me what the TED conference is, what the goal is, and then why Elizabeth Gilbert was a good person to have on this particular panel or this particular part of the conference.
Sure. Well, you know, TED began as a conference focused on technology, entertainment, and design. That's the TED in TED. Over the years, we grew ever broader. Now we incorporate anyone with an idea worth spreading, whether that's an architect or an entrepreneur, a philosopher, or a photographer. Every speaker gets 18 minutes on stage to give the talk of their lives. Then we take all of those talks and we put them online and distribute them to the world. You can really think of TED as a clearinghouse for great ideas. And Elizabeth was a great choice for TED because she is so articulate about the creative process. And it's actually very hard to find creative people who can actually articulate where their inspiration comes from and how to protect it.
We're going to talk more with June in just a little bit. But first, let's hear Elizabeth Gilbert's TED Talk.
Creative people across all genres, it seems, have this reputation for being enormously mentally unstable. And somehow we've completely internalized and accepted collectively this notion that creativity and suffering are somehow inherently linked, and that artistry, in the end, will always ultimately lead to anguish. And the question that I want to ask everybody here today is, are you guys all cool with that idea? Like, are you comfortable with that? Because you look at it even from an inch away and, you know, I'm not at all comfortable with that assumption. I think it's odious and I also think it's dangerous and I don't want to see it perpetuated into the next century. I think better if we encourage, you know, our great creative minds to live you know? And so the question becomes how, you know? And so it seems to me, upon a lot of reflection, that the way that I have to work now in order to continue writing is that I have to create some sort of protective psychological construct, right? I have to sort of find some way to have a safe distance, you know, between me as I am writing and my very natural anxiety about what the reaction to that writing is going to be from now on. And as I've been looking over the last year for, like, models for how to do that, I've been sort of looking across time, and I've been trying to find, like, other societies to see if they might have had better and saner ideas than we have about how to help creative people sort of manage the inherent emotional risks of creativity. And that search has led me to ancient Greece and ancient Rome. So stay with me, because it does circle around back. But ancient Greece and ancient Rome, people did not happen to believe that creativity came from human beings back then, okay? People believed that creativity was this divine attendant spirit that came to human beings from some distant and unknowable source for distant and unknowable reasons. The Greeks famously called these divine attendant spirits of creativity daemons. Socrates famously believed that he had a daemon who spoke wisdom to him from afar. The Romans had the same idea, but they called that sort of disembodied creative spirit a genius, which is great, because the Romans did not actually think that a genius was a particularly clever individual. They believed that a genius was this sort of magical divine entity who was believed to literally live in the walls of an artist's studio, kind of like Dobby, the house elf, and who would come out and sort of invisibly assist the artist with their work and would shape the outcome of that work. So brilliant, there it is, right there, that distance that I'm talking about, that psychological construct to protect you from the results of your work. And then the Renaissance came and everything changed, and we had this big idea, and the big idea was, let's put the individual human being at the center of the universe, right? Above all gods and mysteries, and there's no more room for, like, mystical creatures who take dictation from the divine, and it's the beginning of rational humanism, and people started to believe that creativity came completely from the self of the individual. And for the first time in history, you start to hear people referring to this or that artist as being a genius rather than having a genius. And I got to tell you, I think that was a huge error. You know, I think that allowing somebody, like one mere person, to believe that he or she is like the vessel, you know, like the font and the essence and the source of all divine, creative, unknowable, eternal mystery is just like a smidge too much responsibility to put on one fragile human psyche. It's like asking somebody to swallow the sun, you know? It just completely warps and distorts egos, and it creates all these unmanageable expectations about performance, and I think the pressure of that has been killing off our artists for the last 500 years. And if this is true, and I think it is true, the question becomes, you know, what now? You know, can we do this differently? Maybe go back to some more ancient understanding about the relationship between humans and the creative mystery? Maybe not. You know, like, maybe we can't just erase 500 years of rational humanistic thought in one 18-minute speech. And there's probably people in this audience who would raise, like, really legitimate scientific suspicions about the notion of basically fairies who follow people around, like, rubbing fairy juice on their projects and stuff. Like, I'm not probably going to bring you all along with me on this. But the question that I kind of want to pose is, you know, why not? Why not think about it this way? Because it makes as much sense as anything else I have ever heard in terms of explaining the utter maddening capriciousness of the creative process, a process which, as anybody who has ever tried to make something, which is to say, as basically everyone here knows, does not always behave rationally, and in fact can sometimes feel downright paranormal. You know, like, even I have had work or ideas come through me from a source that I honestly cannot identify. And what is that thing? And how are we to relate to it in a way that will not make us lose our minds, but in fact might actually keep us sane? And for me, the best contemporary example that I have of how to do that is the musician Tom Waits, who I got to interview several years ago on a magazine assignment. And we were talking about this. And, you know, you know, Tom, I mean, for most of his life, he was pretty much the embodiment of the tormented contemporary modern artist, you know, like trying to control and manage and dominate these sort of uncontrollable creative impulses, you know, that were totally internalized. But then he got older and he got calmer. And one day he was driving down the freeway in Los Angeles, he told me, and this is when it all changed for him. And he's like speeding along, and all of a sudden he hears this little fragment of melody, you know, that comes into his head as inspiration often comes, elusive and tantalizing, and he wants it, you know, it's gorgeous, and he longs for it, but he has no way to get it. He doesn't have a piece of paper, he doesn't have a pencil, he doesn't have a tape recorder. So he starts to feel all that old anxiety start to rise in him, like, I'm gonna lose this thing, you know, and then I'm gonna be haunted by this song forever, and I'm not good enough, and I can't do it. And instead of panicking, he just stopped that whole mental process, and he did something completely novel. He just looked up at the sky and he said, excuse me, can you not see that I'm driving? Do I look like I can write down a song right now? You know, if you really want to exist, come back at a more opportune moment when I can take care of you. Otherwise, go bother somebody else today. Go bother Leonard Cohen, you know? And his whole work process changed after that. Not the work. The work was still, like, oftentimes as dark as ever, you know? But the process and the heavy anxiety around it was released when he took the genie, the genius, out of him, where it was causing nothing but trouble, and released it kind of back where it came from, and realized that this didn't have to be this internalized, tormented thing. It could be this peculiar, wondrous, bizarre collaboration, kind of conversation between Tom and the strange external thing that was not quite Tom. So when I heard that story, it started to shift a little bit the way that I worked too, and it already saved me once, this idea. It saved me when I was in the middle of writing Eat, Pray, Love, and I fell into one of those sort of pits of despair that we all fall into when we're working on something and it's not coming, and you start to think, this is going to be a disaster, this is going to be the worst book ever written. Not just bad, but the worst book ever written. And I started to think, I should just dump this project, you know? But then I remembered Tom talking to the open air, and I tried it. So I just lifted my face up from the manuscript and I directed my comments to an empty corner of the room, and I said aloud, listen, you thing, you and I both know that if this book isn't brilliant, that is not entirely my fault, right? Because you can see that I am putting everything I have into this. You know, I don't have any more than this. So if you want it to be better, then you got to show up and do your part of the deal, okay? But if you don't do that, you know what? The hell with it. I'm going to keep writing anyway because that's my job. And I would please like the record to reflect today that I showed up for my part of the job. Because, thank you. In the end, it's like this, okay? Centuries ago, in the deserts of North Africa, people used to gather for these moonlight dances of sacred dance and music that would go on for hours and hours until dawn. And they were always magnificent because the dancers were professionals and they were terrific, right? But every once in a while, very rarely, something would happen and one of these performers would actually become transcendent. And I know you know what I'm talking about because I know you've all seen at some point in your life a performance like this, you know? And it was like time would stop and the dancer would sort of step through some kind of portal, and he wasn't doing anything different than he had ever done, you know, 1,000 nights before, but everything would align, and all of a sudden, he would no longer appear to be merely human. You know, he would be like lit from within and lit from below and all like lit up on fire with divinity. And when this happened back then, people knew it for what it was. You know, they called it by its name. They would put their hands together and they would start to chant, Allah, 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 God, God, God. That's God, you know? Curious historical footnote. When the Moors invaded southern Spain, they took this custom with them, and the pronunciation changed over the centuries from Allah, Allah, Allah to ole, 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 which you still hear in bullfights and in flamenco dances in Spain when a performer has done something impossible and magic. Allah, ole, ole, Allah, magnificent, bravo, incomprehensible, there it is, a glimpse of God. Which is great, because we need that, but the tricky bit comes the next morning, right, for the dancer himself, when he wakes up and discovers that it's Tuesday at 11 a.m. and he's no longer a glimpse of God. He's just an aging mortal with really bad knees, and you know, maybe he's never going to ascend to that height again, and maybe nobody will ever chant God's name again as he spins, and what is he then to do with the rest of his life? This is hard. This is one of the most painful reconciliations to make in a creative life, you know? But maybe it doesn't have to be quite so full of anguish if you never happened to believe in the first place that the most extraordinary aspects of your being came from you. But maybe if you just believed that they were on loan to you, you know, from some unimaginable source for some exquisite portion of your life to be passed along when you're finished with somebody else. And, you know, if we think about it this way, it starts to change everything. You know, this is how I've started to think, and this is certainly how I was thinking about it in the last few months, you know, as I've been working on the book that will soon be published as the dangerously, frighteningly over-anticipated follow-up to my freakish success. And what I have to sort of keep telling myself when I get really psyched out about that is don't be afraid. Don't be daunted. Just do your job. Continue to show up for your piece of it, whatever that might be. If your job is to dance, do your dance. If the divine cockeyed genius assigned to your case decides to let some sort of wonderment be glimpsed for just one moment through your efforts, then ole. And if not, do your dance anyhow. And ole to you nonetheless. I believe this and I feel like we must teach it. Ole to you nonetheless, just for having the sheer human love and stubbornness to keep showing up. Thank you.
Thank you. That was writer Elizabeth Gilbert speaking at TED in 2009. With me now is June Cohen, executive producer for TED Media, who worked with Elizabeth to develop her TED Talk. June, this talk is titled Nurturing Creativity. And Elizabeth was fairly candid about the insecurities that come with creative success.
I love the way she talked about the dark side of success in her talk because you very rarely see people who are courageous enough to do so. We always assume that success is always a good thing, that we envy it, we aspire toward it, but nobody ever tells you about the dark side of what happens once you do succeed. I loved when Elizabeth talked about the fears that success creates and the fears it creates in others for you.
Elizabeth asks the audience to take a big leap of faith and talk about things that you can't see and touch and muses and spirits in the walls in front of an audience of mover, shaker, scientists, engineers who are used to, you know, even though they may be creative, are used to tactile science and definitive things, not sprites in the wall. What kind of conversation did you have about that? Or did it not occur to you maybe? I don't know.
Well, we didn't talk about, we did not talk up front about the spiritual aspect of her talk or the metaphysical aspect of her talk. And I actually think that everybody in the audience was ready to embrace that.
They were willing to take the jump?
As a metaphorical journey.
Sure.
Whether you actually believe in the muse or the sprites, or whether you just welcome that as a useful metaphor mm-hmm. for helping you through a creative impasse, I think everybody was able to find something in Elizabeth's talk that resonated with them.
Oh, I thought she meant it.
I actually picture them all the time.
I know, right?
You know, and there's another thing. I actually think that Elizabeth's talk was amazingly universal. She really framed her talk in terms of the writer's journey and the particular pressures that are placed on writers. But I think that her message has resonance to a much broader audience, whether you're a scientist, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're a part-time photographer or an amateur athlete, everybody faces the same sets of challenges and questions about their own success, their own last success, and whether their next success will come. For many of us, our work does require a leap of creative faith.
June, why do the talks about the creative process seem to be so popular?
There seems to be such a hunger in the world for talks about the creative process. And I think that's because we're all essentially creative beings. If you think about it, before mass media, before the Industrial Revolution, our ancestors were essentially creative every single day. They made their clothes, they built their homes, they made music, they told stories. And we all still have that essential creative impulse inside of us, whether or not it's being expressed in our actual work. And so that's why I think people look to advice for how to unlock their own creativity, because they feel it inside of them and want to be able to express it. But what's interesting is that it's actually quite hard to find a good talk on the creative process.
Oh, that is interesting. Why is that?
I think it's partially because there's a sort of a shroud of mystery around the creative process. None of us are exactly sure where it comes from. I think it's also partially because many artists are not linear thinkers. And so it's difficult for them to express where their creativity comes from or how it takes form in a way that the rest of us can follow. That's one of the things that makes Liz Gilbert so unique. She is so creatively expressive in her writing, but is also able to unpack that process for us in a way that can be used not only by other writers, but by anyone.
June Cohen is executive producer of TED Media. June, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Allison. It's such fun to be here.
You can find dozens more TED Talks on the creative process. Go to TED.com. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. Today on the program, we've been talking about the creative process, where we find our inspiration. Our next guest had to travel halfway across the world to find her voice.
Going North Carolina, baby mine. Going North Carolina, baby mine. Going North Carolina, and from there off to China. Going off to China, baby mine.
Abigail Washburn is a banjo player who performed earlier this year at TED. But being a musician wasn't the career she first had in mind. After traveling through China during college, she fell in love with the country and the idea of becoming a lawyer in Beijing.
And I was dead set on doing that. And basically, within a period of thinking I was headed off to law school in Beijing, I heard the sound of Doc Watson singing and playing Shady Grove. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my darling, Shady Grove, my little love, going back to Harlan. And I thought the sound was so beautiful. And after being completely obsessed with Chinese culture for 8 years, I was so relieved and so excited to hear something so distinctly American and so completely beautiful. And I knew that I had to buy a banjo and take it with me to China. So before I left for China, I went on this road trip through Appalachia, and I studied banjo tunes at a fiddler's gathering in West Virginia, and I ended up at the International Bluegrass Music Association Convention in Louisville, Kentucky, and I thought, okay, here we go. This is my last little slice of America before I'm off to China, and I was sitting in a hallway one night, and a few young women came up to me and asked me if I wanted to jam, and I was literally timidly jamming out on the five songs I knew, and I got offered a record deal. Some record executive walked up to me from Nashville, Tennessee, and said, come on down to Nashville and cut a record. And I guess you could say, the Chinese-speaking banjo picking girl.
Some of your most innovative work is the way you blend Chinese language and the clawhammer banjo. It was really such an unusual sensation when you took the stage at TED in 2012. Let's listen to a little bit of that performance.
What was it that made you feel so connected with China and Chinese culture that you thought, you know what, I'm going to incorporate this into my music?
Well, for me, that's simple. It was that China came first. China had a few years on folk music. So as soon as I started playing music, you know, as soon as that record executive walked up to me and offered me a record deal, and I started becoming a professional musician, my first song I wrote was in English, and my second one was literally in Chinese. It went, and that means, outside your door, the world is waiting. Inside your heart, a voice is calling. The four corners of the world are waiting. So go get it, girl. Travel, daughter, travel. So for me, my creative inspiration was also in Chinese.
Abigail, did you know you were a creative person before you settled into your music career?
I don't think I really thought about it that way. And even now, I've been able to have really interesting discussions with my other friends who are artists and musicians about what creativity really is. Is it an original idea? Or is it something where you literally are creative collages? You're taking pieces of the world that you see around you and that are inside of you and put them together in a way that you see fit. And then all of a sudden you have something that maybe sounds a bit unique. But does that make it an original idea? These are a lot of the conversations I have late at night, especially with my collaborator right now that I'm on the road with, Kai Welch. We will sort of try to keep ourselves awake late at night at 4 a.m. trying to finish that drive from one city to the next, and we'll get into this. And I'm definitely a believer in that creativity is actually more like a collaging. And I suppose I've done that my whole life. I would say I've always lived creatively, but now I do it with an intention that's got a completely different power.
We'll talk about collaboration in a minute, but first, we'd love to hear some music. Maybe hear City of Refuge, the title cut from your most recent release.
Yeah, here we go. Started.
That's Abigail Washburn and the City of Refuge. Listening to you play the banjo, and I think anybody who's played a musical instrument, you know that it takes practice and it takes hard work to learn an instrument and to master it like that. So I'm curious about your thoughts on the relationship between discipline and creativity. The discipline to learn the instrument and then the ability to let yourself be creative with it. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not a trained musician. All I've been able to figure out from this is that we're only as great as our ability to negotiate and take advantage of our limitations. And so I've decided my limitations are not only okay, but they're an incredible opportunity to think about what it is I can do with what I have. And so I try to temper continually my technical growth on my instrument and with my voice with what I know I have to give already, which is an open heart, a searching heart. So as I'm trying to advance and use discipline to become a better technical musician and even create moments and periods of time in my life where I have the open time and space to practice and become better, I'm also trying to remember that it's living life and feeling empathy and having hope and a mission that really makes the music meaningful.
So, Abigail, we're going to give you artist choice. Tell us what song you're going to play and why you chose it.
I'm going to choose an old-time tune that comes from Blind Willie Johnson and his song that he recorded in the 1930s called Nobody's Fault But Mine.
Nobody's fault but of mine. Nobody's fault but mine. If I die, yeah, my soul be lost. It's nobody's fault but mine. I had a mother who could pray. I had a mother who could pray. She prayed all day and into the night. I had a mother who could pray. Nobody's fault but mine. Nobody's fault but mine. If I die and my soul be lost, nobody's fault but
That's Abigail Washburn, who's joining us on the TED Radio Hour. And the theme this hour is the creative process. Abigail, is there any environment that really helps you tap into your creativity when you need to write or you need to think about lyrics?
Yeah, that's a big reason why I just sang that song. Something that's really, really powerful for me when I need a new idea is I listen to the old ones. I go turn on Blind Willie Johnson, or I go get my Goodbye Babylon box set and I start listening to old preachers preach, or I listen to old speeches. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech always sends me down some path, some trajectory of some creative idea. Yeah, I listen to the old to get an idea for the new.
When you performed at TED, you chose to perform a song, you did it a cappella, called Dreams of Nectar.
The first day I stepped foot in this fair country, border man took my paper, told me I would be free. Border man took my paper, told me I was now free.
Share with us a little bit why you chose that to perform at TED and a little bit of the backstory.
Dreams of Nectar is a song that began a long time before any of those lyrics or melodies came to me. I chose to share it at TED because such a huge part of what I do and what I care about is people's stories and how they relate to how we're globalizing and changing in the world. And this one particular song has a story connected to it that is harkens back to my time when I was still thought I was going to be studying law in China, and I was studying for the HSK living in Montpelier, Vermont. And I just couldn't stop thinking about China and wasn't getting my fix, you know? Mm-hmm. So it ended up that, who would have thought it, but at the local Chinese restaurant, the China Star, there was 7 Chinese men working away, and they all had come to America to earn money to send back to their families and hope that someday they'd be able to bring their families over to America to be with them. And I learned this because I became their English as a second language teacher. And there was one guy in particular in the group that was having just a terrible time learning English. And I decided to invite him over to my house once a week to get some extra extra work done on his English. And he showed up at the door one night, and then I suddenly noticed that he was crying. And I said, "你怎么回事?" What's wrong? And he held out his hand, and it had a piece of paper in it, and he said, "你自己看吧." Look for yourself. So I opened up the letter, and it was from his wife back in Fujian province. And it said, "你已经在美国4年了." You've already been in America for 4 years. I'm afraid you're not ever going to come back to China. And I'm afraid your child and I are never going to be able to come to America to be with you. We're going to start a new life without you. Consider this the end. And he cried and cried, and I watched him. And I didn't know what to do with that until I started writing songs.
Let's listen to a little bit of Abigail Washburn at TED 2012 with Dreams of Nectar.
I'm just old now, all alone, in a land of fertile lies. I see my unborn babies and tired birds in the sky. I see my unborn babies, tired birds in the sky. Before I die, grant me one thing. Grant one thing to me. Don't let me dream of nectar. Just make me fruit on the tree. Thank you.
In doing press for this most recent release, City of Refuge, you described your writing process as evolving and that initially it was a very private thing. So how is it going, evolving from that very private solo space into the rest of the world?
I've noticed that the more I open up, the more I learn. So I'm incredibly grateful for that. But I'm not going to lie. I can feel really vulnerable and kind of scared sometimes when I sit down to write in any kind of situation that invites a collaborator in. But I think that maybe that adds an electricity to the situation, an excitement, a vulnerability that maybe brings something to the music that wouldn't be there otherwise. So one of the reasons I probably have remained somewhat private about it is perhaps a point of pride, but I don't want to become someone who writes a song simply for the sake of the craft of writing song. I really want every song to be filled with that extremely human element of longing for it to take something to the world. So I come to every song with a huge amount of intention. Although I've had a couple friends say to me who are good songwriters say, "Hey, why don't you just start writing songs and don't worry about whether they're good or not." Maybe they're right. I'll keep thinking about that.
Maybe they're not.
Maybe they're not.
No. Abigail Washburn, it was a pleasure speaking and listening to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Allison.
Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Megan Kane, and Sam Greenspan. Special thanks to the young poets at 826 DC. And thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Janet Lee, Emily McManus, and Darren Triff. And thanks to NPR's Eric Newsom. I'm Allison Stewart. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.